Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Samach Vav and Aleph by the two dots. Haushchemera, dichtiv la gita l'dibitu. This individual who was on his deathbed, and he wrote a get to his wife. The reason that he wrote a get to his wife is that he doesn't want her to be subject to Yibum. So in order to protect her from Yibum, he gives her a get. In gedvednach, he was sighing, he was groaning, moaning. She realized that he was upset about divorcing his wife. Obviously, it's not a simple thing to divorce your wife. He's doing it to protect her, but he knows also that by divorcing his wife, he's no longer married to her. Amra le, amai ka mitnachat. She said, why are you groaning and moaning? Ikayamt didachana. If you survive, I'm still yours. So what he was afraid of is that if he makes it through this sickness, he pulls through, now he's divorced from his wife, and someone else could have married her. She has no commitment, not locked into him. And so he is miserable about the fact that he's giving the get. And obviously he didn't put a tnai or a condition in the get, which would have been the easiest way to deal with this, which is, imeti micholizeh. If I die from this sickness, then the get should be a get miachshav, or me achayim, it should be a get, and it would have worked. But he didn't put the condition in the get. He gave the get. And then afterwards, she, to console him, says, well, this condition is kind of there. I'm yours if you survive. Amar Rav Zvid, p'tumei mila be'almahu. She owes him nothing. The condition is not binding. It's simply words. She is speaking without a commitment. She's just trying to console him in this situation. Amar Rav Acha midifti the Ravina, v'ilav p'tulei mila mai. Even if she wasn't considered to be just speaking and not bound by her commitment, why does it matter? Because b'dida kaima the mishtei tana b'gita. Since when is it in the woman's purview to determine any conditions in the get? B'didei kaima the mishtei tana. It's in the husband's purview to create the tna'im of the get. The husband is the one who gives the get. He is the one that must make the conditions or the exceptions in the get. Her statement shouldn't be binding anyway, or her statement shouldn't be meaningful. Even if you were to say it wasn't p'tumei mila, even if you were to say it wasn't something where she was just speaking and there's legal ramifications to her statement, it still would be problematic because she isn't the one who can make that decision or enter the conditions into the get. So ma'u d'teima, what we'd have thought, hu gufei aidaita dido kagamir v'yoiv gita. Maybe we would have thought that his giving of the get is premised on the conditions that she stipulated, and therefore, even though she technically doesn't have the right to set the conditions, nevertheless, when he gives the get, he has in mind or he considers what she has said, and therefore it becomes incorporated in the, call it, quote-unquote, transaction here, in the divorce here, that her condition would qualify the giving of the get. Kamash Malan, that we don't say that. And that her statement here has no bearing, both because of the fact that it's p'tumei mila, that it is just simply, she's trying to console him, it has no normative effect on the get, but also from the perspective that you would have thought maybe her statement could be incorporated in his action, the Kamash Malan is that we don't say that, that it has to derive from him in order to be a proper condition. Over here, the Balei Tosafot speak about something that they speak about much more extensively in the Gemara in Kiddushin, and we've discussed also in other places, which is umdina demilta, which is how do we look at a context of a situation which gives us information about what exactly the intent of the individual was. And so there, the Balei Tosafot have three categories of what they called giloi milta. And over here he notes that kamash malan moshe mashma mahocha, that someone on their deathbed who is divorcing a woman, stam, without any conditions, without any qualifications, imamad eno chozer beget. If he survives, it's not automatic that the get is reversed in this situation. Whereas with a gift, we know, matznat shchiv meira, the gift of someone's on their deathbed, if they survive, the gift is reversed. It's automatic. That is the default, which is that it's obvious the reason that he's gifting the property is because he's on his deathbed. So you would have thought to say the same thing by a get. The fact is that he's giving the get only because he's on his deathbed. Otherwise, he wouldn't have given the get. So why isn't that implicitly a condition of the get. And over here, the Balei Tosfot say, from here you see that that's just not the case. And Umikan Makshir Rabbeinu Tam al Perisha Kuntris and the Rabbeinu Chananel. Here, Rabbeinu Tam questions Rashi and the Rabbeinu Chananel, the Perishu, that they say that Amar Rav Huna Misha Achzo in the Gemara and Gitin, Gito Harehu Kematanato. There we learned in the Gemara and Gitin that the get has the same din as a matana. And the way that Rashi and Rabbeinu Chananel read it, Ma Matanato Imamad Chuzer, Af Im Gito Imamad Chuzer. So Rashi and Rabbeinu Chananel believe that the two are intertwined. Just like when you give a gift, if you survive, it is not considered to be a gift. So too, when you give a get, if you survive, it's ois get. It's not a get anymore. And that's based on the Gemara that equates Gito the Matanato. Uperush Ashtam Shchiv Meira Koi. And over there, it's talking about a Stam Shchiv Meira without any qualifications. But the Rabbeinu Tam says our Gemara seems to indicate otherwise. Our Gemara here, where there was no stipulation, and here, even though there was a stipulation after the fact, it doesn't help. So now, if that's the case where it's explicit, it doesn't help, then how could you argue that implicitly, it's automatic that you would be get out of the get? And therefore, the Rabbeinu Tam says, that's not right. It can't be by a get stam. It has to be a get where you specify that there's a tnai embedded. It is not automatic that that is the case. Miu, yesh tomar, tesugi dehocha, ushmil plige a Rabbi Huna. It's a possibility that it's a machloket a sugiot, and that would then leave Rashi and Rabbeinu Chananel's position intact. But otherwise, this Gemara seems to indicate by a get that there's not an automatic assumption just because you're a Shechiv Meira that that becomes a condition of the get. And again, Tosafot speaks about this in other contexts because context makes a difference. For instance, the Gemara there speaks about someone who sells all their property to make Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael and then fails to make Aliyah, whether they can reverse all the transactions, because it was clear the only reason they were selling their property was to make Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. So Tosafot over there gives guidelines in the Gemara in Kiddushin and in Ketubot as to when we consider the context so obvious that it is an embedded condition in the transaction. Where do we have a situation in which you have to articulate the fact that there is a condition there? And where is there a situation in which if it's not even written, it's not enough. I mean, it has to be included in the transaction in order for it to be binding. The Tosafot gives different levels of implicit or where you need explicit conditions in order for something to go through. Now, here's one of these where you see the argument between Rashi and Rabbeinu Chananel will think that Shechiv Meira, it's implicit in a Shechiv Meira that it should have unwound automatically. Our Sugya clearly says otherwise. The Rabbeinu Tam reads that as saying that that's the general principle by get. Whereas you could argue, like the Balei Tosafot, that this sugya disagrees with the sugya in Gitin. And the truth is that here it believes that a get does not have that built into it. I think you could argue that for the Rabbeinu Tam, the way to differentiate between a get and a matana is that a matana is something unusual. So unusual over here because of the fact that he gives away all of his property. And so the problem, matnat Shechiv Meira, means that he really believes he's going to die over here. And since he believes he dies, he gives away all of his property. The Gemara says if he keeps any of his property and he doesn't give it all away, then it's binding because then he had in mind already that he might survive. So there where he gives away all of his property, it's so obvious that nobody leaves themselves penniless in that situation that he's only giving it away because he's Shechiv Meira. And yet, it's not self-evident. I mean, look, you understand maybe why he would do it now, but it's not necessarily self-evident that he is doing it only because of this or the reasons behind it. Over there, where you give away all your property, it's self-evident why he's doing it or what it's connected to. So I think that's the way you would have to differentiate between a matana and a get. I think Rashi and Rabbeinu Chananel's reading seems much more plausible, which is that they're the same and that they are very similar. All right. Gemara says, Hilvayo al Sadehu. So in the Mishnah, it describes a case of Baitus Ben Zonim, where he lends him money with the field as collateral. And he says, if he defaults on the loan in 3 years, then the field is mine. Now, from the simple reading of the Mishnah, that sounds like every loan, which is that you have a specific period of time in which to repay it. You fail to repay it, then the collateral stays with the malveh. What is so unusual about this transaction? This is what the Gemara says here. Here's the Chiddush. Amar Rav Huna, b'shat matan maot, kana akol. Lachar matan maot, lokana el keneged ma'utav. So what you see from this statement of Rav Huna is that the collateral is worth far more than the outstanding loan. At the time that the loan was taken out, he gave him the land as collateral. The land as collateral, and this is generally true with collateral as well, even today when banks want to lend you money or they give you a mortgage, they want the value of the underlying asset to far exceed the amount of debt that you have outstanding, so that gives them protection. So the same thing over here, the collateral taken far exceeded the amount of the debt outstanding. But then it says, if you default after 3 years, then the entire property goes to the buyer here, or in essence, the lender of the money. So now you have a problem, which is that he's getting paid back far in excess of what the loan was worth. He purchased the property at a discounted price. And that involves what we're going to see in our sugya now, a problem of asmachta. Does the person who's giving the collateral really believe in the end that he's going to lose the collateral? Or he's only simply posting the collateral to make the lender happy so that he'll actually lend him the money, but not that he believes that he'll really lose the karka. So Rav Huna says, "Bishat matan ma'ot." If at the time that the loan was given, then this was the condition stipulated, it was all explained up front, and he says, I'm posting this as collateral, and I know that in 3 years, if I default, the property's gone. Kanako. Then the lender gets the entirety of the property. We don't consider it to be a problematic transaction, or the person didn't really believe he's going to lose it, because he knows the only reason he's getting the money is because he agreed to this condition. And therefore he knows that the condition is integral to him getting the money, and therefore he knows it's really possible that it's going to happen. Lachar matan ma'ot, if the transaction already happened, which means that the loan has already been extended, lo kana el keneged ma'utav. At that point, if he posts the collateral and makes this condition, if he defaults, then the buyer, or the lender, only gets to collect on collateral the value of the loan that is outstanding. Because it's clear that it's not integral to the loan because he gave the loan already. So it's definitely the debtor trying to placate the creditor. So he says things, maybe even things that he doesn't intend to carry out, in order to keep the creditor at bay, to put him at ease. And so therefore it's not binding. The way that our Gemara reads is very interesting. Lo kana el keneged ma'utav. He only gets the value of his loan in the collateral. Rashi over here says, if you look in Bishat Matan Ma'ot, he says, Hitna amanat kein koneako, v'im lachar matan ma'ot hitne, ein bedvarav klum. It's meaningless. He gets zero. So as opposed to our Gemara that reads, el keneged ma'utav, Rashi says, ein bedvarav klum. It's meaningless. So the Baalei Tosafot already take up this issue and say, wait a minute. The Gemara says in Rav Huna's statement that he gets at least what his money is worth. At least he gets the repayment of the debt through the land. Rashi says it's meaningless. Now, later on in the Gemara, we're going to see that there is a shita like that. And Rashi is clearly reading in the later part of the Gemara into the earlier part. You still have to explain why it says here that kana el keneged ma'utav. So Tosfot over here says, Ve'ish lomar, dohocha ha'perusho. L'char matan ma'ot lo kana, ela im hitne imo k'nei l'guvayna. Kani, keneged ma'utav. Tosfot again, reading like Rashi into the final part of the sugya, says that it only works if not that he made an asmachta. Asmachta, which we'll discuss in 1 second, where he promised him land that was far in excess of the value of the loan, and then it's clear, based on this from Rav Huna, it doesn't work, there's no kinyan over there. So if there's no kinyan, then it fails entirely, and he's entitled to nothing. So the Baalei Tosafot said, not only did he make a condition or an agreement that stated that he was entitled to all of the property, he also made a kinyan that says you will collect from this property. So even though the first kinyan fails, the second kinyan, or the second stipulation, works. And that's why over here it says that he collects keneged ma'utav. So again, we're going to see this later on in the sugya, but if you put together a kinyan where the premises of the kinyan or underlying the kinyan are false or problematic, then the whole thing falls apart. You don't have to keep anything. So Tosafot, in order to solve the problem of our Gemara, says that there are actually two stipulations. One stipulation is, if you default, you're going to give me the whole property, and my collection will be from this property. So those are two different statements. The one that fails is the fact that you're going to get the whole property. It exceeds the value of the loan. The one that still stands is the one that you're going to get your collection out of this property. And that's why it says here, keneged ma'utav. And that's why Rashi explains it ain't b'dvarav klum, because that's really what the Gemara says later on. Rav Nachman amar, afilu la'achar matan ma'ot kana kol. Nachman says, even after the loan is already outstanding, if he makes such a promise, the kinyan goes through. Avad Rav Nachman uvda gabe resh galuta. Rav Nachman, who is a dayan of the resh galuta, he married Yalta, and Yalta is from the house of the exilarch. So by his, through marriage, he was elevated to be a part of the resh galuta, but he's also known as a dayan mumchak. We know that from stories that we've seen before, that Rav Nachman says about himself, and we'll see in the sugya as well, that Shmuel used to say that I'm like Shavur Malka, that I'm like the king. Meaning that when it comes to dinim, I'm the man. So we know that he has strong positions with regards to din, and we actually pass him like him. That's one of the Klalei Apsak, that when it comes to a din, halacha k'Rav Nachman. So he was of the Uvda Beis Shagluta, Kishmate, based on his own position, which is that even after the fact, if you make a promise, even though it exceeds the value of the loan, it goes through. Kare Rav Yehuda l'shtarei. Rav Yehuda got a hold of the shtar and ripped it up. So now, Rav Nachman is a Talmid of Shmuel. He many times mentions Memrot in the name of Shmuel. Sounds like he worked as one of the Sofrim in the Beit Din of Shmuel. Whether that was his Rav Muvchak is not clear. Probably Rav Barvua was his Rav Muvchak. But he definitely has a strong connection with Shmuel. Rav Yehuda, we know already, also learned by Rav, and then learned by Shmuel later on. And so Rav Yehuda is likely probably about a half generation older than Rav Nachman, because Rav Nachman learns by Talmid of Rav, as well as by Shmuel. And Rav Yehuda learns by Rav, and then by Shmuel. So it's indicative of the fact that he's about a half generation older. And from the Gemara in Kiddushin, we know that Rav Nachman shows tremendous amount of respect towards Rav Yehuda. So here Rav Yehuda rips up the shtar that Rav Nachman had validated. Amar le resh galuta, Rav Yehuda kara le shtarech. He says, how can you let this happen? Rav Yehuda's ripping up a shtar that you validated and said is fine. Amar le dardaka kare. Is this some young whippersnapper that's ripping it up? Gavarabo kare. Somebody big. This is a big gun who's ripping up the shtar. Chaza beitaimo vikare. He must have seen something here, and he ripped it up. So here, Rav Nachman, in defense of Rav Yehuda, and not to make it look like he's undermining the standing of Rav Nachman, says to the Reish Galuta, it must be that Rav Yehuda saw something that made sense to rip it up. Not necessarily that it was against the reason of Rav Nachman. Maybe it was another issue that he saw, but for whatever reason, he felt justified in ripping it up. We know the reason that he's ripping it up is because he disagrees with Rav Nachman over here, and that's why he's ripping it up. But Rav Nachman, in his defense, says that he's a gavarabo, and we have to rely on him. Igadamre. Some say, Amarle, Dardaka, Kare. He says, some young whippersnapper ripping it up. Tekuli alma, legabi didi bedina, Dardake ninu. Because in relationship to me, in dinim, there's nobody like me. Everybody else is considered to be like a child, and child's play. So the fact that he ripped it up is not going to bother me, because I know I'm right. So that's a big difference in the statement. In one case, or the first statement, we see Rav Nachman acknowledging that Rav Yehuda has stature, and that respectfully saying that if Rav Yehuda did this, there must be some reason behind it. In the second case, Rav Nachman says, I don't see this as undermining my position because I'm right. And I'm always right when it comes to dinim. Now, it's not necessarily gaiva. He just knows that in this area, this is his expertise. In this area, if somebody else disagrees, he's not so worried about it because he believes that he is correct. Although, Hadar Amar Rav Nachman, we have Rav Nachman who reversed his position. And so, interesting enough, it actually supports much more heavily the first explanation, which is that he gives credit to Rav Yehuda, because Rav Nachman himself reverses his position over here. Afilu b'shat matan ma'ot, lo kana v'lo klum. So over here, even at the time of giving the money, I mean, at the time of the loan, it fails. Meaning that if you make the condition then, which Rav Huna, who was the more machmir opinion, at least there, said it works. He said it doesn't work after the loan is extended. Rav Nachman disagreed and said it works all the time. Now Rav Nachman's going to the other extreme and saying it never works. Doesn't work after the loan, doesn't work when the loan is given out as well. So now you have Rav Nachman reversing his position. Again, that would be much more supportive of him being respectful of what Rav Yehuda did. Eitvei Rovo Rav Nachman. Rovo is a Talmud Mufak of Rav Nachman. And we see a number of times that Rava questions Rav Nachman. We saw instances where Rav Nachman does not respond to him. And Rava, in the end, says Rav Nachman was right for not responding to me because my he'ara was not a good point that should have been made. And again, Rav Nachman in general tells him, don't question me during the middle of cases. Only question me after the fact. Over here, he says, im yatanu teinli mikanav et shloshanim, hari shali, hari shalo. Our Mishnah. He questions Rav Nachman from our Mishnah. Our Mishnah seems to be exactly the case that is being described here. And now Rav Nachman all of a sudden is saying, there is no situation in which this works. At least for Rav Huna, you can claim the case of our Mishnah is a case where they made the condition at the time that the loan was being extended, and that's why it works. If you did it afterwards, it wouldn't work. But now that Rav Nachman says it never works, whether you do it at the time of the loan or after the loan, then how do you explain our Mishnah? Amalei, ani omer, asmachta kanyo. Now here, Rava's question now, based on the answer we know, is based on Rav Nachman's original opinion, which is, I say, asmachta kanyo. I say that an asmachta does make a kinyan. Umenyume amar asmachta lo kanyo. And Menyume, on the other hand, says that an asmachta doesn't work. Ule Menyume kasha matnitin. And for Menyume, our Mishnah is a problem. So now, you have Rav Nachman, who here is explaining both his original position. His original position was that it works, whether at the time of the loan or after the loan, it works. And Rav Nachman says, my position is based on the fact that asmachta kanyo. Now, he also has to explain the dissenting opinion. The dissenting opinion is Menyume, who says that asmachta lo kanyo. Asmachta doesn't work. Rav Nachman, who later on changes his position to agree with Menyume and say that asmachta lo kanyo, then has to deal with the same problem that Menyume has to deal with, which is our Mishnah. Because if asmachta lo kanyo, how does the situation in the Mishnah work out? And so therefore what he says here is, Menyume says asmachta lo kanyo, and Menyume has a problem with the Mishnah. And now here are the answers for Menyume. Those will also be the answers for Rav Nachman once he has changed his mind to agree with Menyume. Asmachta has different meanings in the Gemara. Usually in the monetary context, asmachta means something where a person enters into a transaction or some sort of binding agreement in which they don't really believe that they're going to have to carry out or execute on whatever they have committed to. Now, that can be for different reasons. They might not think they have to do it because it's what's called derech guzma. They were exaggerating. They exaggerated in order to win the trust of the other party. So they say something that they don't really mean or intend to carry out. They just say it to make the other party happy. So that's one way. The other way is where he thinks he has control over the situation. Since he has control, he believes that he will steer it in a direction in which he won't lose, or he'll never come to the side that is a loss. So all of these conditions make it that he does not have gemirat hadat. He does not have full-fledged intent at the time of the transaction that the transaction is for real. And that's necessary or integral to any transaction is gemira tadat. That's why we make a kinyan. The whole point of a kinyan is to show that there is finality to what has happened here and demonstrate through your action that there is actually a binding agreement between us and that we don't tend to walk away. Asmachta, in some senses, undermines that gemira tadat. Because the asmachta says that I'm relying on a positive outcome so that I'll never have to deal with the promise that I gave over here. So then you have to then at that point determine when the person makes a condition or the person offers something, how sincerely are they offering it? What is their intent in terms of what they offer? So Rav Nachman at first supports a position of asmachta kanyo. It's actually a machloket in the Gemara, Daf Daled Amud Bet in Sanhedrin, machloket Tanaim as well. And over there, the Gemara discusses who the halacha is like and their major implications over there for lottery tickets, gambling, all of these things that involve a certain amount of asmachta to them. It's not really the topic of our Gemara over here, because here asmachta deals with a different aspect of asmachta, which is entering into contracts where there are penalties involved. And since there's a penalty involved, how realistic is it that the person really believes he's going to have to pay the penalty or that he's going to commit to it? Our case is a classic case of that, which is if you default, you're going to lose the entire property. Well, that means that you're going to lose more than you borrowed. That means that he's promising him a property far in excess of the value of what he borrowed. So in that situation, do we view the penalty as being a reasonable penalty and he really meant to give it? Or do we say that he was simply doing it in order to win the trust of the creditor, but he never really intended to give him the whole property? And so you here have, in the beginning, a machlok between Rav Huna and Rav Nachman as to how this works. At first, Rav Nachman says, "Asmachta kanyo," and therefore, it works whether you did it at the time of the loan, or you did it even after the loan. Because when you give a promise, we assume that that's binding. Even though there's possible outcomes where you would not have to carry it out. Even maybe you have doubts about it. Nevertheless, it's enough, according to Rav Nachman, "Asmachta kanyo," that that is enough to create a kinyan and have a binding agreement here. Manume disagrees. The problem we have here is, what is the shita of Rav Huna? Rav Huna, over here, who suggests that when it's at Matan Ma'ot, it is good. Achar Matan Ma'ot, it's not good. What is Rav Huna's shita? So you can see over here that you have a very large Tosafot that is trying to do exactly that, figure out what Rav Huna said. He says, Mi'o the Rav Huna, yesh li tein tam, de bishat ma'ot, matan ma'ot, lo chashiv le'asmachta. How come at the time of the extension of the loan, that's not considered to be a smachta? Whereas at the time where he does it after the fact, he's trying to placate the creditor and says, I'll give you this. Over there we say it's an asmachta and it doesn't work. So he suggests over here that the difference for Rav Huna is not an asmachta, but rather, the haltam b'dinar darim vadeyav asmachta dein chefes shitkayem aknas vaguzma. He says, when you talk about intangible items, or you make promises that are simply words, over there, since there's no physical object upon which you are committing to do something, that is considered to be an asmachta. Ela matne kach lasmicha veiro advrav. And he's only saying them in order to win the trust of the other party or get the other party to enter the transaction. Aval hocha, in our case, al dat kein malveu ma'utav. Over here, the only reason he's extending the loan is because of this promise. Shedeya sadev shukat biyado, that the field stays in his possession, im lo yitein ad shloshanim. And not only that, there might even be a kinyan over here, although that's not so clear because during a loan or the extension of the loan, there really isn't any kinyan involved. What you have to say is that he makes a kinyan on the mashkom, or he takes some sort of possession of the mashkom. So it makes it much more real or realistic. And that's why Rav Huna over here says there's a difference. Rav Huna in general believes a smachta lo kanyo. When it comes to an asmachta, it doesn't work. Then why does it work? Or why is the kinyan successful when you do it at the time of the loan? Because at the time of the loan, it's very realistic. He is, first of all, only lending him the money on this premise. And number two is he's handing over the land to him as a mashkon, but like a physical giving, almost a sale of the land at that point. Right? He's handing him the keys in a sense. So that he really understands the ramifications of what he's saying. And therefore, there is gemirat hadat, and it's not considered to be an asmachta. That's the first way that Tosafot explains the shita of Rav Huna, saying that Rav Huna believes asmachta lo kanya in general, but over here it's an exception to the case, because this case is different than your classic case of asmachta. He says, obviously for Rav Nachman you can't say that, because Rav Nachman lets it happen no matter what, and therefore Rav Nachman's of the opinion, as we see in the Gemara, asmach kanya, at least based on his original position. And Tosafot goes on to explain, umfarishri, shetam shaveh l'shnehem. The Reed disagrees and says that Rav Nachman and Rav Huna are not dealing with different reasons, but rather they have the same reason. Over here, our case is very different than a normal case of asmachta. Because at the beginning of the outset of the transaction, it's a little bit like a transaction rather than a loan. He's basically handing him over the whole property as a Torat Mashkon. And he's also giving him consideration with regards to the lending or the extension of the loan. Therefore, when he agrees to it, it really works. Because Mishum da Adifa ha Asmachta Meshar Asmachta. Because this Asmachta is stronger than any other Asmachta. Everyone agrees here that's an Asmachta, but the asmachta over here has strength to it that does not exist in other situations because of the way that it is structured. And the way that it's structured is that he's handing him property. It looks like a sale of the property up front or a delayed sale of the property, as well as the fact that he's extending the loan based on this. And therefore, Ati Shapir, that works even Limnume or the Rav Nachman Bata Adre. It works even for Minyume or for Rav Nachman after he changed his opinion. Minyume Dvahani Achshav below Beitin Chashuv. And Tosfot goes on to show that over here, the Gemara seems to indicate in the answer that we're going to give him Minyume, what happened in our Mishnah, it gives an answer. The answer seems to disagree with the Gemara Nidarim that says that this answer is not sufficient. Doing this is not as sufficient to overcome an asmachta. It's only enough to do it if you do it in front of a Beitin Chashuv. Our Gemara never makes that demand. Tosfot says, why not? Why doesn't our Gemara make the same demand that the Gemara Nidarim makes? His answer is, our case is different. The asmachta in this case is a much stronger asmachta, meaning that there's much more realistic views that this will be the outcome, and therefore it only demands a little more, not a lot more, to solidify it. The Gemara Nidarim is going to require what we require here, plus a Beit Din Choshuv. Our Gemara will only require what it says here, but not the Beit Din Choshuv. And Tosfot says that's supportive of the Ri's claim that this asmachta is stronger than other cases. Once you do that, then you can explain the different opinions here in the Gemara, and it may not have to do with their opinions, or necessarily agree with their opinions in other places with regards to asmachta. They might have a different opinion on asmachta in other places in Shas, because this case is different. This is not your classic case of asmachta, because of the difference over here. But the Rabbeinu Tam says a similar thing, that he says, the halacha kani mishum de tafis, because over here he's taking possession of the actual item. And in taking possession of the actual item, again, it makes it a stronger form of kinyan that is not your classic case of asmachta. And that's very important here as to whether you can extend the opinions that they have here to other places in Shas, as well as why the requirements here are a lower threshold, or why Rav Huna would have an opinion that differentiates between the zman of the loan versus afterwards. So now the question is, according to Mnume, who says, Asmachta lo kanya, what does he do with our Mishnah? Ibai deima matnitan Rabbi Yosihi, damar asmachta kanya. No problem. The author of our Mishnah is of a different opinion. The author of the Mishnah is Rabbi Yosi, who believes that asmachta kanya. And Mnume is going to hold like the Tanaim that believe, asmachta lo kanya. So that's not a problem. You're right. The Mishnah is according to an opinion that doesn't subscribe to this position. Ibai deima, damarle, kene me'achshav. He says, take possession of it from today. So this is where the Balei Tosfot point out that the Gemara Nidarim says that's not sufficient. You need Kenei Me'achshav, plus you need Beit Din Choshuv. How come over here the Gemara only requires Kenei Me'achshav? The answer is because here there's a much stronger tie between the lender and the land that makes it at the threshold to make it into a Kinyan Gamur, Gemir Zadat, is lower. And when you say Kenei Me'achshav, take possession of it today, meaning that retroactively, the loan extended would become a purchase immediately. That gives much more tokif to it. It's not that when you default in 3 years, then you get the land in place of the loan. It's as if I sold it to you today if you default later. So basically the sale is done. It's only a question if he buys his way out of it later on by returning the money. So that makes it much more of a gmirat hadat. And that's what Rashi says over here. Yibayitei medamalei machshav knei, im lo atein lecha ad shlosh shanim, the lava smachtehi. You bought it today. He sold the property today with an option to buy it back. But that's all it is. It's an option. But the sale is complete and there's full gemira tadat over here. That's what he's saying. Even according to Mnume, who believes asmachta lo kanya, this is not an asmachta. This is full gemira tadat. And again, the threshold for making a gemira tadat is lower here, as the Balei Tosfot say, because of the nature of the transaction over here. Now the peirot, as Rashi notes, will be the machloket between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbanan what to do with them. According to the Rabbanan, the peirot in the interim, you'd have to put them into escrow until you figure out who really owns the land, because otherwise, if he defaults and the land becomes that of the buyer, the lender over here, no problem, because he was eating his own fruit all the way along. If he buys it back, then you have a problem, because if the lender was eating the fruits along the way, it's interest, basically, and he has to either pay for the fruit, or we keep it in escrow to figure out who it belongs to. The other possibility is Rabbi Yehuda, who said, Sarah Echad Beribit is Mutar. So according to Rabbi Yehuda, then the lender can take the fruits, because there's two outcomes here. One outcome is Ribit, one outcome is not Ribit. There's no problem for you to take it up front and eat the fruits all the way along. So that'll be the question of what you do with the production of the land. But over here, the way we solve the problem is to basically take away the asmachta. So even though Minyume holds In general, Asmachta doesn't work. Our Mishnah is not a case of Asmachta. So Amalei Mar Yinoko, Mar Kshisha, Bnei Rav Chista, the Rav Ashi. So you have Rav Chista's children, the younger one and the older one, Mr. Older and Mr. Younger. They Hachi Amrei Naradai Mishmei the Rav Nachman. This is what the Naradai say in the name of Rav Nachman. Hai Asmachta Bizmane Kanya, Blozmane Lo Kanya. When it comes to an Asmachta, if it's at the time, it's koneh. If it's not at the time, it's not koneh. So Amrlei, kol midei bizmane koneh, blozmane lo koneh. Says, this has nothing to do with asmachta, this is true of any transaction. What they're saying is that when the due date shows up, then it sounds like whatever happens is not considered to be asmachta. But if it's not at the due date, then it is an asmachta. And Rav Ashi says back to them, I'm not sure I really understand what you're saying, because anytime you have a transaction or you have some sort of kinyan, it only goes effective at the date of the due date of the loan. I mean, that's when the default happens. That's when anything that was supposed to happen gets triggered. Nobody thinks it gets triggered prior to that point in time. So I'm not sure why you're making a distinction within a smachta. This is a distinction that applies even for a kinyan gamur. The kinyan gamur only goes effective when there's a default, meaning that's the time period it happens. Dilma hachi kamritu. This is maybe what you were thinking, or this is what you heard. Ashkechei b'go zimnei, if he found him before the expiry of the loan, meaning that it's still outstanding and it's not due yet. V'amarlei, knei, if he says to him, take possession of it, kani, it works. And the kinyan works. Batar zmanei, if it's already after he's defaulted, and then he sees him, v'amarlei, knei, he says him, take the property, lo kani, it doesn't work. So what Rav Ashi is suggesting back to them is that when he offers up the land as an alternative form of payment, do we really believe that he's offering that as an alternative form of payment? So what Rav Ashi says, it makes a difference when he does it. If he does it while the loan is still outstanding, he was under no obligation to make that offer. The fact that he made that offer is all voluntary. That means that he must have really meant it when he made the offer. The other hand, when he makes the offer after he's already passed the time for repayment, he's already defaulting basically on the loan, and he makes such an offer, how can you really take him seriously? The only reason he's doing it is to buy himself more time. That he doesn't really want to sell the land. He doesn't want to really give the land. He's simply doing this to buy himself more time, and therefore, it wouldn't work. My time, huh? The only reason he's offering it is Mahmat Kitsufo de Kamarlei. Because he's embarrassed. And he has nothing else to offer him, so he kind of offers him up some sort of candy so that he waits a little longer and he doesn't get upset. He's trying to pacify him. He's not really intending to give him the karka in this case. Velohi, the Gemara says it's not true. Da'afilu bigo zimnei nami. Even within the term of the loan, lo kani, it doesn't work. V'hai dekamarlei kani. So how come, why did he offer him the option to take the property? He was under no duress. He didn't have to pay anything yet. The due date of the loan hadn't come. So why is he making this voluntary offering when there's no necessity for it? So we would think it's a real kinyan. And yet, the Gemara is saying, no. Kasavar kimatu zimne loleti litardan. He says, because I know the due date is coming. And when the due date comes, he's going to come after me. He's preemptively trying to ward off the creditor by making him this offer, even though the due date has yet to be reached. If I tell him now, here, take the property, and that'll be in lieu of payment, he'll be calmer. He'll be pacified. And then when it comes to the due date, he's not going to panic and be all over me. He'll give me more leeway. He's going to give me more time because he knows that his loan is protected. It doesn't work. I mean, that's exactly what he's saying. Now, this is no different than after he's already defaulted, because in both cases, he's not really intending to do it. But the same logic is being applied. He's just trying to placate the creditor. And in placating the creditor, he does not really mean to give it over. Amar Rav Papa. So now Rav Papa comes along and says, Hai esmachta zimnin kanya, v'zimnin lo kanya. Sometimes an esmachta works. Sometimes an esmachta doesn't work. Ashkechei deka shoti shichra koni. If on the due date he shows up and he finds him kicking back with a beer, enjoying himself, relaxed, not stressed at all. He's koneh. The kinyan goes through. Because it's clear here that he doesn't think he's going to come up with the cash. And that he is resigned to the fact that the property is gone. And that he's giving up the property. Because there's no way out of this. Because if he really believed there's a way out, he'd be scrambling to get the cash. which is the other option. If he's running around trying to get cash and to stave off foreclosure on the property, then lokani, because there it's clear that his intent is not to allow the kinyan to go through, and therefore it remains as an asmachta. Amalei ravacha midifti the rabina, dilmei lifkuche pachadei koshati. Who says that drinking a beer is a sign of calmness? Drinking a beer sometimes, and we see this by with regards to avelut. Then Rashi quotes the other side of this, which is yain yisamach levav enosh, that wine makes people happy, but we also have it that people drink the mare nefesh. But those are in bitter situations, they drink in order to forget their bitterness, to push away their worries. And so that's what he's saying here. How do you know he's not drinking in order to wash away his troubles and not have to think about the situation at hand? Drinking is not a sign necessarily of calmness. Drinking sometimes is a sign of too much stress or tremendous difficulty. And again, the Gemara speaks about that in Avelut, that they used to drink wine, because wine was a way to take away from the bitterness of Avelut. Later on, the Chazal were mitake not to do it because the people were getting drunk during the Avelut, and it went too far. But you could understand this idea of drinking in order to wash away or to forget the pressures that you're under right now. And therefore, I don't see that as being evidence of the fact that he really is resigned, and there's Gmir Tadad over here. Inami, Inish Achrina, Asmeche Azuzei. Or he has someone else that he's relying on that's going to give him the money. He's already lined up the situation, and therefore he has the money, he just needs a little more time to get it and to put it together. And therefore he's drinking because he has no worry over here. If that's the case, it's not evidence of the fact that there really is Gemir Tadat over here. Ela Omar Ravina. Ravina offers a different way to test to whether the person is serious about what they're doing or not serious about what they're doing. Ikapid bidomi vadei koni. If he's very makpid on the money, then it definitely works. Rashi over here says, im makpid mimichirat chavatzav shelo lefachot mishovyan. If he never sells his property or his possessions at less than their fair value, and over here he's giving it at less than fair value, it's clear that he intends to give it. Because there's no reason for him to agree to give in excess of what he owes. And the fact that he offered it means that he must really mean it, because in no other situation does he willing to sell something at below its value. Samalei Rav Acha midifti the Ravina, Dilma Salvar, maybe he believes Keichid lo titzel arei. He's trying to protect against the deflation of his other assets. Because if he's under duress to raise cash, everybody knows he's in a corner, and they're going to offer him less money for his assets. So he will then cause a depreciation in all of his portfolio because of the fact that he's desperate for cash. So he's willing to offer this guy in excess of his value just to get him off his back so that he doesn't depreciate the value of the remainder of his assets. And therefore, maybe his intent here is not really to give over the property, but simply to protect the remainder of his assets so people don't have a run on his assets. Hello, I'm Rav Papa. Rav Papa here offers the alternative. E kopid ba'aro, if he is makpin on land, vaday koni, then it definitely works. Rashi over here says that kopid ka'ara means that he normally does not sell land under any condition. He will never sell land. Even at its fair value, he won't sell land. And now all of a sudden he's offering up land. The fact that he's offering up land means that he must be serious about this, because he never sells land. He would never give up his land, not for any price, even at their fair value. So therefore, when he makes the offer over here, he must be serious, and his intent is to have Gemir Tadat and the offering of the land. That's the way that Rashi reads it. The Balei HaTosafot think that Rashi's explanation is very difficult, and therefore they come up with an explanation which is much more common amongst the Rishonim to explain the difference over here. Nir lefaresh, ikapid bidmei, shehikpid bishat halvaa, likach aleha shovya bizatznai. That at the time of the loan, he made sure that the condition was premised on the land being equal to the value of the loan. Well, if it's equal to the value of the loan, what's the question? The answer is that it might have appreciated in value since then, and the land now might be worth much more than the loan. But the fact that he was makpid at the time of the loan to say that the land is worth exactly the amount of the loan and not in excess of that amount, it shows you that he was serious about this and he knew that he could really lose the land for the debt because he put in an equation that said that this land will belong to you and this is its value today. And Racha Ben Dipti comes back and says, wait a minute. The reason he might have done that or been willing to accept the fact that and he's makpid on the exact value of the land is not because he really believes he's going to have to give it up, but rather is in order to protect the remainder of his assets so that people don't think that he's desperate for cash and he's selling under duress and therefore they're going to pay less for his property because they know he's under pressure to raise capital. And the answer of the Gemara is, ikapid ba'ara, she'enu rotze lasot tnai zeh b'shum karka ela b'zo. That he's unwilling to put this condition into the loan with land in general, only on this particular piece of land. The fact that he is makpid on the exact property that he's encumbering for this loan, that shows you that he really believes he's going to lose or might lose this property. Because otherwise he would have just offered a general lien, or any piece of land would have been the same, because he never thinks he or intended for it to go to the other party. Over here, where he specifies and says only this land can be the collateral for the property, that's indicative of the fact that he believes he might lose the property. Therefore, he's making a choice as to which property he's going to lose, and it means that he really believes that he might lose the property. So that is the way that the Balei Tosafot see it over here. And again, there are different permutations of this in the Rishonim, but along the same lines of what the Balei Tosafot are saying is that Kapira Mamona or a kapita aro means that either he's very particular about fair price or fair value of what he's giving, and kapita aro is either that he is very makpid to go with only a specific piece of property, or others suggest that he just doesn't give a full piece of property, he gives a subsection of the property, which is equal to the value of the loan. So something that specifies that he knows exactly what he's giving, and that he knows he might lose it, and therefore he's very particular about what the size of land is, which piece of land it is, which is indicative of the fact that he really believes he might lose it over here. Ferramara Papa, Afagab da Murabonon, Asmachta Lokanyo, even though the Rabbonon in general say that Asmachta doesn't work, Aputuke Havya the Migvamine, it is considered to be directed collateral in order to collect from it. Or in essence, what Papa is saying is that liquidated damages are fair. That you should be able to be compensated for your losses over here, even though the penalty or the agreement gave you something far in excess of what you should be entitled to. And so therefore the penalty is considered to be unfair, and it is null and void, but you should at least be entitled to liquidated damages. So this is very interesting, because this goes back to what we discussed at the beginning of the sugya as to Rashi's interpretation when the Gemara says that when you do it shelo bizman matan ma'ot, then you collect only against the amount of the loan and not in excess of that. And Rashi over there says lo amar v'lo klum, you get nothing in that case. And here you have Rav Papa making a statement that says that if someone promises you something way in excess of what you deserve, and it's an asmachta, therefore the kinyan is not good. The kinyan is only not good with regards to the excesses, with the exaggerations, the penalties. But the core damages that you owe, or the core value that you owe, that it still functions for. So that's interesting. Amalei Rav Huna, Brei Rav Natan, Rav Papa, Mi Kamalei Knei Luguvaina. Where's the kinyan for that? The reason the kinyan failed in the beginning was because the person never really believed that he was going to have to carry out or give up this property. But that means you have a failed kinyan. If you have a failed kinyan, then how could you then make a claim that he has a right to foreclose on the property for the amount of the loan? He has no kinyan here because the kinyan that he made failed because of the asmachta. We don't say, well, it fails for the excess. It works for the principal amount or the amount that is fair. It means the kinyan fails completely. And therefore, Rav Huna Bar Natan says, how do you have any kinyan here whatsoever? Amalei Marzutra, Breda Rav Mari Ravina, V'yamar k'nei l'migva minei k'ani. Even if he says, take it as a possession to collect from it, would he be k'nei it? Sof, asmachti. In the end, it's an asmachta, v'asmachta lo kanyo. If the whole transaction surrounds this conceptually excess payment, then if we believe that that is not considered to be a real kinyan, then no matter what the circumstances are, or no matter what he says, it's not going to work, because he never really believed that he's going to pay it, or he never really believed he was going to be obligated to pay it. And therefore, it's an asmachta that fails. And if it fails, you have no kinyan or no right to foreclose on the property, even for the value of the loan. Ella aputuki dekamara papa mahi. Then what is this aputuki that Rav Papa is speaking about? Damalei lo yehelecha piron elamizo. Means that you will only have collection out of this property. Now that is the definition of aputuki. Aputuki is directed collateral rather than just general collateral, which is then you have a general lien against all this property. A putuki is where you have directed collateral. There's a specific property or a specific item that is set aside upon which you have a claim as collateral for the loan that you made. And Rashi says, af betoch shloshanim, even within the 3 years, im ein ani noten lecha migufa keneged ma'utecha, if I do not give it to you from it itself against your money, ad shloshanim tei kula shocha, the entirety should be yours. Ba'amar papa, afagav de lokanyo, mehavi kule didei, even though the stipulation at the end of the period that it will be all yours doesn't work, mehavi kule didei lachagimot to be yours entirely after the 3 years, aputei avi le mikva minei, the collection right existed, the balava smachta namia shabi aputuki. Because even without that final transaction, he made it or gave him the right of collection from it. Or in essence, what Rashi is saying is that he separates out or gives him two commitments. One commitment is, you will take your collection out of this property, period. And that means even within the 3 year period, you have a right to collect from it, because he gave that as an option or an alternative in lieu of cash payment. And then at the end of the 3 years, if you default, then you get the entirety of the property, even though it exceeds the value of your loan. But because they're two separate transactions or commitments over here, one will survive and the other will not survive. Like they say in contracts today, at the end of the contract, it says that if any part of the contract is found to be null and void, it does not void the entire contract, but only those areas that are problematic. The remainder of the contract remains what's called severability. You can separate it out from the parts that are problematic. And so too over here. The after 3 years that he gets the whole property is problematic. The fact that he offered it as directed collateral now, that's fine. So we're going to separate the two. And the directed collateral will remain directed collateral. And the promise to give it after 3 years is an asmachta and it's lokanyo. So through that, you're able to generate both claims against the individual. And that goes back to what we said at the beginning of the sugya. Rashi says, if he didn't do it, the zman matan ma'ot, then it doesn't work. If it doesn't work, according to Rav Huna, then it shouldn't work at all. And that's what Rashi says, aimed at the Rav Klum. That's the conclusion of our sugya here. If you make a transaction or enter a transaction that's an asmachta, then the transaction fails and you have no right of collection, even for the true amount of the loan. On the other hand, the Balei Tosafot bring the conclusion of the Gemara here, which is, not only did he make a kinyan for the asmachta, he must have also made a kinyan for the right of collection. And that's what gives him a right of collection, keneged ma'utav over there, because he had two kinyanim. And that's how Tosafot explains it. Again, based on the conclusion of our Gemara here, on what Rav Papa is suggesting. Now Tosafot over here says, let's try to understand better, what is the problem with the asmachta lokani over here? It says here, even if he offers him for a right of collection from this property, it still fails because of the fact that it was done in a context of an asmachta lokanya. So unless you can separate out the two items and have a separate kinyan for each of them, then it's going to fail because of asmachta lokanya. It does not only not give you a right to the property or the penalty in excess of the value that you deserve, doesn't even give you a right to the value itself. Now Tosfot here tries to understand what is the root of what is called asmachta. And he says here, Delo abi asmachta lahecha. The definition of asmachta is de'ein biyado afagav delo gozim. When it's not in his control, even though he did not exaggerate, even though he did not offer something that was more than the value that he should have given, nevertheless, if it's out of his control, that is considered to be an asmachta. Since you have no influence over this situation, it's clear here that you don't believe that the bad outcome will happen, and you're leaving it up to chance, And in leaving it up to chance, you don't believe you're ever going to be held accountable or responsible for whatever you promised. Or Tosfot says, "Ohechi digozim afagav debiyado." Or in a case where even though it's within your control, but your offer is exaggerated, which are the cases that we have here. So even though it's within his control to pay it back, nevertheless, he's offering property that is in value far in excess of what he borrowed. So that's a case of gozim. So those are the conditions in which it's considered to be an asmachta. But in a case where he's not exaggerating, and it's in his control as to whether the outcome will be positive or negative, over there, lo chashiva asmachta. That's not classified as asmachta. And therefore, Tosfot asks, what is the asmachta over here? V'hocha, my asmachta ika, inotin lo karka b'chovo. If he gives him the land for an exchange of his loan, why is there any asmachta over here? It's biyado. He had the ability to pay back the loan or not pay back the loan. As well as the fact that it's not a guzma. It's not an exaggeration. He's giving him back the property, connected the value of his loan. B'yosh lomar, you have to say, the choshiv kimo gozim. It is like an exaggeration. The fish ain't adam rikol limkor karkutav klau. People in general don't sell their land. In their day, when you own land or being a landowner, that was the ultimate, both in the sense of wealth and stored value, but also in the ability for one to sustain themselves. Your ability to produce, especially crops or food, was essential to your survival. And therefore, owning land was such an integral part of a person's ownership that they would never sell it. The fact that he offered up land as collateral or as payment in lieu of the loan, that already is a guzma, Tosfot says, because people don't sell land in general. And therefore, underlying the offer to give the karka as a means of collection inherently involves an asmachta, because he doesn't really believe that he's going to have to give up the property. In a sense, he's exaggerating the fact that his collection will be from this property. So unless he separately and specifically states that his collection is from this property, that his collection will be from this property, and he dedicates that as the means of payment, then it's not going to work, because your right of collection is subsumed under the bigger offer, which involves him taking the entirety of this property, even in excess of the value of the property. And the fact that you're giving up property at all is already somewhat of a guzma, and therefore you need very particular gemira tadat in order for that to be considered the mechanism or vehicle of payment. Although you should know that Tosafot in other places, with regards to Breira and Eruvin, mentioned sometimes that when something is out of your control completely, that it's not considered to be an asmachta. The question really comes up where either a person believes it's totally within their control, or they have somewhat control over the outcome, then they really believe they can influence it. But in a situation where they believe they have absolutely no influence over the outcome, then in a sense they're resigned to the fact that it's leaving their control. And therefore maybe in those situations it's not considered to be an asmachta, because they know for certain that they won't control the outcome, and they're giving up whatever they're giving up as consideration to enter into this transaction because of the fact that they know that whatever happens, happens, and that might be enough of a gemira tadat. So there are situations in which the lack of control might also actually remove the asmachta, if the lack of control is so far out of their control where they really believe that they are resigning or abdicating any influence over the outcome of the situation. And so in summary here, there's really a fundamental machloke between Rashi, and on the other hand, the Ramban, and the Balei Tosafot that we just explained are also a part of this, which is that Rashi believes that there's only an asmachta here when the price of the property is significantly different than the underlying value of the loan. Either that he's discounting the price of the property, or he's giving him more property than he really deserves based on the value of the loan. And that's what generates the asmachta here, is the fact that he's giving up more value than he owes based on the loan. On the other hand, the Balei Tosafot, the Ramban, believe that the fact that he's willing to offer karka itself is the asmachta. Even if you give it at fair value, the fact that he's willing to give up land, That is an asmachta, and that's what Tosafot just described. Both of them say later on, when it comes to the wine that we're going to see later on in the Gemara, the mere fact that he's willing to sell wine, either at before a time that people normally sell it, or sell it at all, makes it into an asmachta. Whereas for Rashi, Rashi has to explain that the wine changed in value somehow, and therefore the asmachta is the difference in the value of the wine and the underlying obligation that is there. And so for Rashi, the asmachta is the difference in value of what he's receiving versus how much he lent out, versus for the Baal Tosfot and the Ramban, it's the mere fact that he's offering something besides cash as the repayment of the loan, especially karka, where people don't normally sell karka. This also leads to an additional machloket between them, which is when Rav Papa over here says that even though the asmachta fails, there is an apotiki, Rashi explains the case as being where he explicitly says that there is an apotiki. He says within the first 3 years, you will take payment out of here. And then if you foreclose in the end, you'll get the whole property. And then Rashi continues to say that you will only have right of collection out of that property itself. And so either you take the property as payment, and that's what makes it okay because he offered it as payment and the only form of payment. Otherwise, when it reaches the end of term and then the whole property becomes yours, that doesn't work because it's a smachta lo kanya. But the way to solve the problem of the discount that creates the asmachta is to create another statement or indication that you have rights of collection from this property. Ramban argues on both of those points and says, number one, the aputuki here is created implicitly and not explicitly. And when it says, the amarle that he said to him, do te'elecha piron el mizil, that's implicit because he lent them the money on this land. And implicit in that is that he will take collection out of this land. In addition, the borrower still has a right to pay him in cash or to pay him with the land. He does not have to pay him through the land. Now, the Ramban, in all likelihood, says this because simply stating that you have a right to collect out of the land doesn't solve the problem for the Ramban. Ramban believes that it's an asmachta anytime you offer karka. And so what he has to say is that even when you offer karka, which is an asmachta, underlying that, Rav Papa suggests, is an apotiki, a right of collection from the property because you only lent him because the property was there. And so that collateralization of the property is implicit in the offer to use the property as a means of payment. So even though it fails in terms of the asmachta side of it as a means of payment in the end, it still functions as the collateral for the loan. And therefore, either you can get paid cash or the karka itself for the loan. That's a very important distinction that persists for Rashi and Ramban throughout the sugya as to what is creating the asmacht over here. Rashi, it's always created by the differential in value versus the obligation. Whereas for the Ramban, it's the mere fact that you're offering something besides cash, especially land, that makes it into an asmacht.
There was this individual who sold property to his friend with recourse, meaning that if the property got confiscated, then he'd have to replace the property. So Amalei, the buyer says to him, Itarfule minai, if they confiscate the property from me because of an outstanding issue that you had, creditors or any other thing, migretli mi ide iditiluch, I want from the best of the best of your property to replace it. Amalei, the seller says back to him, mi ide idit lo magvinalach, I will not give you from the best of my best property. Debein on the makeum kamai, because I want to keep that for myself. Ella magvina lacha midit acherim deitli. I'll give you from the good property or the best property I have that's below this idit, the best of the best. So normally in these situations, a creditor would only have rights to benonit, middle range property. Over here, he is stipulating that he's going to give him better than middle range property. He's going to give him upper range property. The individual asks for a super upper range property. The seller denies him that right in recourse and says that he can only have really good property, not the best property, because he wants to keep the best property for himself. So, tarfua mine. In the end, the property was confiscated from the buyer. Creditors came and foreclosed on the property, or for whatever reason, they came and took it away. Ata bidka. But also, it happened to be that a flood came. Shakal the ide idit, and washed away his best of the best property. The seller who had refused to give up his ide idit now lost his ide idit because there was a flood. And either the flood washed over the fields and the fields are no longer usable, or they washed over the fields and they took the earth, the dirt from the better fields and placed them in the other fields. So those fields that were originally the best fields are no longer the best fields because it was washed away. So now he made a promise originally to give up Edith. But that was only because he believed that he had better quality property he was going to keep for himself. So Savra Papa the Meimar, Papa thought to say, Mi Edith Amarle Vahakaimo. He promised him Edith, and the Edith is still extant. He'll have to give him the Edith as payment for the recourse. Amarle Ravacha Midifti Ravina Vilemele Kiamilcha Ano Magvinalach Dabe Edith Kaimo. The only reason I allowed you this benefit of collecting from the best of my property is because I believed, or at the time, I had property that was even in excess of that quality or value, and I kept that for myself, and I was giving you the edit. Hashto kaimele edit b'makom ide edit. Now that my ide edit, the best of my property, was washed away, then the edit, the best property, which I had promised to you, is now my best of the best. It's now changed its status in the stack, because I no longer have something that is better quality than this property. And so truthfully, this sounds very similar to a machloket that we saw in the Gemara Baba Kama, which is that when we look at the property of an individual, how do we assess the levels of property? Bididei Shaminan? Do we look at that individual and it's all relative to the property he himself holds? Or Bidilo Olam Shaminan? Do we look at it vis-a-vis an objective standard, which is, this is considered to be middle range, this is considered to be a better range, vis-a-vis the world, or there is a standard by which property is measured. So that might be their machloket over here, which is, does it change the fact that his best of best went away? Well, if you say it's an objective standard, then edith is edith, and that's what he promised to him. If you say that it's a relative standard, then when his best of best disappeared, then his best becomes the best of best. And that's not what he promised to them. So that's one way you could explain the machloket here. Or you could simply explain the machloket along the lines of what we've been discussing until now, which is the asmachta issue, which is that a person entered into a transaction with a belief or a premise that something was going to happen or be true. And so over here, he's offering him more than he deserves. He only deserves benonit, and he's offering him edit, only because he believes he has Edith in hand. Now when he finds out that he doesn't have Edith in hand, maybe the promise that he made or the offer that he made to give in excess of the true value, he really didn't, in that situation, believe he was going to have to give up the property. He only did it, only committed to it, because of the other factor that is involved. So it's very similar to the asmachtot that we've been talking about till now. Rav Bar Shava, Mamesik Bei Rav Kahana Zuzei, Rabbi Shava was indebted to Rav Kahana. Amalei, ilo prana lecha liyom ploni, gavi me'ai chamra. Says, if I don't pay you by a certain date, take possession of, whether it's my donkey or my wine over here. Sava Rapapa lemeimar, Rapapa thought to say, kiamrin an asmachta lo kanyo. When do we invoke the principle of asmachta lo kanyo? Animile be'aro. That's true by land. Delav lizvune kaimo. Because people don't generally sell land, and that's what Tosafot told us before, that the fact that you're willing to give up land in of itself is a guzma, because people don't generally give up or sell land. Avachamra gave it to Lizvune Kai, but on the other hand, wine, which in most circumstances is sold or is processed and put together in order to sell it, so therefore, Kazuze Dami, it is equivalent or money equivalent. And therefore, when a person offers it, he really intends to offer it. And so over here too, when he offered him the wine, he really intended to pay through the wine. Amalei Ravuna Breder Yeshua the Rapapa Hacha Amrina Mishmei the Rabbo. This is what they say in the name of Rabbo. Kol Dei Lo Kani. Anytime someone phrases a promise or a commitment with the language of Dei, that if it's not Koneh, and that's what happened here. He says Dei Lo Parana Lecha. If I don't pay you by this date, take this wine. And as Rashi notes over here, Upasak Damim Ulusofi Yakir, at the time that they assigned the wine to him, the market price at that time, he was assigning him wine that was equivalent to the loan value. But by the time it came to him defaulting, the price of wine had appreciated, and now he's taking much in excess of what he really deserves. Do we say there's a full-fledged kinyan over here or not? But Papa's suggestion is, when it comes to karka that people don't sell, no kinyan, because it's an asmachta. by wine which people intend to sell, it's no different than cash in that case. And therefore, when he offers it, it's as if he intended for the kinyan to go through and he has real gemira tadat. On the other hand, Ravuna Breda Yeshua suggests over here, in the name of Rabba, any time that the promise or commitment is premised on something happening where he doesn't really believe it's going to happen, then it's not classified or not considered to be a kinyan. Any transaction that involves some sort of future determination rather than an immediate conclusion of whatever is happening, that is considered to be an asmachto. So if there's a kinyan immediately, then there's a gmir tadat. If it premised on some future trigger, that's not considered to be a kinyan or gmir tadat, and it's an asmachto. Now here, where he offered the wine, he never really thought he was going to have to give up the wine, because it says, if I don't pay you, then the wine is yours. Not that the wine is yours, but rather only if I don't pay you. Samar of Nachman, hashter damur rabbanan asmachto lo kanyo. Now that we know that asmachta is not koneh, hadar aro v'hadar peyreh. That means that in a situation in which the individual foreclosed on the property when he was given something that was far in excess of the value that he deserved, if he went ahead and foreclosed and took the property, he has to return the property because there was no proper kinyan for him to take possession of it. But not only does he have to return the property, hadar peyreh, he has to return the fruits of the production of the property. Rashi says over here, hadar peyreh la'achar shalosh. After 3 years, imachlan lo keach, if the buyer eats the fruits after the 3 years, he has to give them back. And that is because there was no formal kinyan, and he's actually taking fruits or monies that he's not entitled to. So he has to return the land and anything of the production of the land after that default at the 3 year period. On the other hand, within the 3 years, as the Gra notes over here, he doesn't have to return the fruits, even though he shouldn't be taking them because it looks like rebeat. But it's not full-fledged rebeat. It's not rebeat tzutza. Even according to the Chachamim who disagreed with Rabbi Yehuda says that tzarachad berebeat, it's mutar legamre. The Chachamim disagreed, don't say that it is rebeat tzutza. They say it's avak rebeat. And we know the rule is with regards to avak rebeat that it's not yotzei b'dayanim. Courts can't forcibly cause the individual to disgorge the rebeat. And therefore, it's only after the 3 years that he has to disgorge the fruits, because there he took it when he wasn't supposed to take it, and there was no kinyan, and he had no right to the fruits at all. Within the 3 years, even though he shouldn't be taking the fruits, when he takes them, it's not a problem or a lack of kinyan. He's taking them as, quote-unquote, rebeat, or avak rebeat is the problem for taking the fruits during that period. And that, the courts can't force him to disgorge. Although, as you can see in the Gra, the Rambam and the Rif both suggest that even within the 3 year period, if he takes the fruits, he's got to disgorge them because his entitlement to them is really premised on the fact that in the back end, if he defaults, the property will be his. And therefore, from the front, he acts as if it is his. And he's taking the fruits because he really thinks that he has a kinyan in the back end. And so therefore, the taking the fruits is not just a problem of avak ribit, but a mekach ta'ut in a sense, because there was no kinyan. Or more likely, it's because they believe that the collection of the fruits here is actually ribit ktsutza, which the courts can force you to disgorge. And therefore, they believe even toch shalosh that he has to disgorge the fruits or the production that he took from the field. Gemara says, the memra, the sovarach nachman mechila b'ta'ut, lo avi mechila. So you're trying to suggest here that Rav Nachman believes that when someone waives their right to something, even though the waiving of the right is on a mistaken premise, that that is not considered to be mechila. Because over here, the reason he's eating the fruits after the 3 years is because the individual thought that he had a commitment to give the property to him, even though it was an asmachta lo kanyo, this individual believed that he made a commitment. He made a commitment to give up the land, even though it's in excess of the value of the loan. And when the creditor came and took the property and starts to eat and utilize whatever is on the property, he mistakenly believes that that's his right. So now, afterwards, when we figure out it's not his right, do we force him to disgorge these ill-gotten profits? So that would mean or indicate that if you do force him to do that, that means mechila b'taot, lo havi mechila. When the person waives their rights to something, even on a false premise, it's not considered to be waiving a right, and therefore he can get his fruits back. Vayitmar, but don't we have Rav Nachman saying something different? Hamocher peiro dekel lechavero. Someone who sells the future production of a palm tree to his friend, which is a davar shelo bali olam, it is something that has yet to be in the world, which you technically can't sell. Amravuna ad shelo bali olam yachol lachzor bo. Before the fruits emerge on the tree, he has a right to walk away from the transaction because he bought something intangible. He bought something shelo bali olam that doesn't exist yet, and that's not a binding transaction. Mishu bali olam, once the fruits exist, and yachol lachzor bo. Then he can no longer renege on the contract or the transaction. Because, as Rashi says, the kasavar, he believes, adam makneh davar shelo bali olam. That an individual can create a transaction about something that shelo bali olam. But that is b'shata mecher, shia mecher chal v'shevo li olam. That he can enter such a transaction, but the transaction only becomes binding once the object enters the world. So you can make a transaction over something that will be in the future, but it won't be binding or it won't be effective until that object actually exists in the world. So according to Rashi, the machloket here between Rav Huna, who here suggests that once the fruits emerge, it works or the transaction is binding, he believes you can sell something that is not yet here or intangible. You just have to wait for it to be tangible for it to be binding. On the other hand, Rav Nachman Amar, af mishibal olam yachol lachzor bo. Even after the fruits emerge, he can back out of the transaction. That's because he believes ein adam makneh davar shelo bali olam. You can't buy, you can't purchase, you can't create a kinyan on something that doesn't exist yet, even though in the future it will exist, or even in the future when it does exist, it's not binding at that time. So that's the way Rashi sees their machloket, fundamental machloket about whether you can sell davar shelo bali olam or not. The Tosfot Reed, on the other hand, believes that they both believe that in makdim davar shelo bali olam, and their machloket is if you do not invalidate that transaction before the items emerge, does then the transaction become binding because the item exists now? And so not that the original transaction was effective. According to Rashi, the original transaction according to Rav Huna is effective. You just have to wait for the fruits to emerge in order to create it, make it binding, but retroactively it's effective. The other end, Rav Nachman believes it doesn't work at all. According to the Reed, everybody agrees that it's not effective from the original time, because you can't sell something that doesn't exist in the world. Once the fruits emerge, and you have yet to nullify the original transaction, does then the transaction prospectively go into effect because the fruits are davar shelo bali olam now? And that's the machlok between Rav Huna and Rav Nachman according to the Reed, but they both agree davar shelo bali olam, you're not able to create a kinyan on. Now, why is that relevant to our case? Because Rav Nachman, Modina, I agree with Rav Huna, with at least according to this point, the shamit v'achil lo mafkina minei. If the person who purchased the davar shelo bali olam, and then eventually it comes into fruition, and he ends up eating it because the individual sold it to him, thought he successfully sold it to him, and now the buyer eats the fruits. So I agree, lo mafkina minei. We do not extract it from him, we don't force him to disgorge that ill-gotten profit. So you see from here that Rav Nachman says that when somebody takes something on a false premise, meaning that the person thinks there was a fair transaction over here, and then the individual who is the buyer goes ahead and exercises his right as a buyer and takes it, even though he's technically not allowed to, we say it's mechila, because the mocher, the seller, thought he really sold it. And therefore, when the buyer takes it, he's mochel on that, even though the mechila was premised on a false assumption that there was a kinyan over here. So now we have a steer in Rav Nachman. Over here in the case of davar shelo bali olam, Rav Nachman says it's mechila. In the case by the loan and the promise to give something in far in excess of the loan in the back end where there's an asmakta lokanya, when he goes and takes the property despite the lack of kinyan and eats the fruits, he has to disgorge them and give them back. So what is the difference between them? My answer is hatam zvine hachava. Over there is a transaction. Over here it is a loan. There are two ways to explain this. Rashi explains the difference being whether it's deemed to be interest or not deemed to be interest. In the case of the loan, if we allow him to keep the fruits and keep this ill-gotten gain, there's not only an issue of the fact that there's mechila and that he gave him something that he didn't deserve on this false premise that the mecher went through, but he's also taking something for a loan that is outstanding, and that is a problem of ribit. And it looks like ribit, kitsutza, Rashi says, because avak ribit is only in situations where the original transaction involved a commercial transaction, not a loan. But over here, it clearly was a loan up front. So this looks like ribit ktsutza. And since it looks like ribit ktsutza, we say there is no mechila, and we force you to disgorge the profits. In the case of the selling of something that shelo ba'al olam, the origination of the transaction, even though now it's really a loan, because of the fact that he didn't really acquire it, nevertheless, the origins of it were a transaction, not a loan. And so the difference is, if the origins were a transaction, then it's a vakribit, and via vakribit, we don't force disgorgement of the profits. On the other hand, in our case, where it started as a loan, and then he has these ill-gotten gains, those ill-gotten gains look like ribit ktsutza, real ribit, and real ribit, we do force a person to disgorge. And even though Rashi over here only terms it as mechsek ribit, but he says it's mechsek ribit ktsutza, and therefore we force you to disgorge it, versus the case by the buying davar shelo ba'al olam, where it is mechsek avak ribit, and we won't force you to disgorge it. That's the way Rashi learns. Other than the Balei HaTosafot question whether that really is the intent of the Gemara over here in the Shita of Rav Nachman, because we find that the distinction between Halva'ah and everything else does not really exist for Rav Nachman, and Rav Nachman seems to have a different distinction, and that's what the Rabbeinu Tam suggests over here, that in Feresh Vadam, Halka Halva'ah, Deova lo hikna ela b'torat mecher, v'mecher enu kum, that's machta lo kanya. By the alva, the origination of the situation is a loan. And the loan then was converted into a purchase, but that purchase was an asmachta lo kanya. There was never any formal kinyan that would have been successful. There is nothing there that makes it his. There wasn't a transaction, there was only a loan. The transaction that derived from the loan was an asmachta, and there the kinyan is not a fair kinyan. And therefore the mechila, the waiving of the rights later on, is not meaningful, because literally there was nothing here that gave him the right to it, because everything was a ta'ut. And that's why the payroll go back. And does what it says, had he given him the fruits, the Torah ribit, he would not have to take them back, because it's a vak ribit. Against what Rashi is saying over here, that it looks like ribit ktsutza, he's saying that it's a vak ribit. But then, aval hatam gabe peirot dekel, zvine, velo mechila betaloti. He really sold it. He really had a transaction. Nehida yachol achzor bo, even though he has a right to renege on the deal because it's not a binding transaction, nevertheless, he wants to stand by his word, and by standing by his word, he would have sold it. So what Tosafot suggests, the Rabbeinu Tam suggests, is that the difference between our case and the case by the Davar Shelo Ba'al Olam, the Davar Shelo Ba'al Olam was really a sale. He wanted to sell it. He entered into a transaction where he thinks he was selling it. The only mistake here was his misunderstanding that you can't sell something Shelo Ba'al Olam. But as far as his intent, and as far as the Kinyan, everything was according to the letter of the law, with the exception of the fact that you can't happen to sell a davar shelo ba'al olam. And therefore, to stand by his word, it makes sense for him to be mochel on the payroll and say that the sale went through. His right of reversal of the transaction is just a technicality, because the kinyan doesn't work with davar shelo ba'al olam. But if he wants to stand by his word, he should uphold the transaction. On the other hand, in our case, the premise of their interaction is a loan. The offer of the land is an asmachta. He didn't really want to sell the land to him. He didn't even want to give him the land at all. And now he's giving him land in excess of the value of the loan, or money or value in excess of the loan. He never intended for that. He never wanted that. And the only way it would have been binding is if there was a proper kinyan, but asmachta lo kanya. That's the whole problem with the kinyan. The whole problem with the kinyan here is his intent is really not to give it. And so therefore, if his intent's not really to give it, then you can't claim that there's an implicit mechila when the other individual eats it. And that'll be the difference here. Whether there's mechila or not has to do with the intent of the seller, quote unquote. When there's a real sale, his intent is to sell it. And therefore, even though the sale is on a mistaken premise, he's mochel on the payroll because that's what he intended to do. In the case where it was a loan and he never intends to sell the item or give over the property, then in that case, you can't claim that his implicit mechila there, because he never really wanted to sell it in the first place. And that's why he fails. So Tosfot sees that as being a problem more focused on the nature of the transaction and the kinyan, and not about repeat, because again he says that it would have been a bak repeat, then there would be no obligation to return it here. Whereas Rashi sees it as being a problem of interest, and the nature of the interest, because a bak repeat is only in cases of mecher, not in cases of a loan. And so the difference between whether it being repeat ktsutza and a bak repeat, the fact that it involves a transaction that begins as a loan, that makes it into a repeat ktsutza, or close to repeat ktsutza, and therefore we want to disgorge it. Whereas by a case of a mecher, there's no issue of repeat at all. Or if there is, it's a bak repeat, and therefore there's no disgorgement of the ill-gotten gains. Okay, we're going to stop here at the last line of Samach Vav Amud Bet.